So today's Bible reading comes from Numbers chapter 11. Now the people complained about their hardships in the hearing of the Lord, and when he heard them, his anger was aroused. Then the fire from the Lord burned among them and consumed some of the outskirts of the camp. When the people cried out to Moses, he prayed to the Lord, and the fire died down, so that people was called Taberah, because fire from the Lord had burned among them. The rabble with them began to crave other food, and among the Israelites started wailing and said, "If only we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt at no cost, also the cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. But now we have lost our appetite. We never see anything but this manna. The manna was like coriander seed and looks like resin. The people went around gathering it and then ground it in a hand mill or crushed it in a mortar. They cooked it in a pot or made it into loaves, and it tasted like something made with olive oil. When the dew settled on the camp at night, the manna also came down. Moses heard the people of every family wailing at the entrance to their tents. The Lord became exceedingly angry, and Moses was troubled. He asked the Lord, 'Why have you brought this trouble on your servant? What have I done to displease you that you put the burden of all these people on me? Did I conceive all these people? Did I give them birth? Why do you tell me to carry them in my arms as a nurse carries an infant to the land you promised on oath to their ancestors? Where can I get meat for all these people? They keep wailing at me. Give us meat to eat. I cannot carry all these people by myself. The burden is too heavy for me. If this is how you are going to treat me, please go ahead and kill me. If I have found favor in your eyes, and do not let me face my own ruin.' The Lord said to Moses, 'Bring me 70 of Israel's elders who are known to you as leaders and officials among the people. Have them come to the tent of meeting that they may stand there with you. I will come down and speak with you there, and I will take some of the power of the Spirit that is on you and put it on them. They will share the burden of the people with you so that you will not have to carry it alone. Tell the people, consecrate yourselves in preparation for tomorrow when you will eat meat. The Lord heard you when you wailed, 'If only we had meat to eat, we were better off in Egypt.' Now the Lord will give you meat and you will eat it. You will not eat it just for one day or 2 days or 5, 10, or 20 days, but for a whole month until it comes out of your nostrils and you loathe it, because you have rejected the Lord who is among you, and you have wailed before him, saying, 'Why did we ever leave Egypt?' But Moses said, 'Here I am among 600,000 men on foot, and you say, I will give them meat to eat for a whole month. Would they have enough if flocks and herds were slaughtered for them? Would they have enough if all the fish in the sea were caught for them?' The Lord answered Moses, 'Is the Lord's arm too short? Now you will see whether or not what I will say will come true for you. I wish that all the people's lords were prophets and that the Lord would put his spirit on them.' Then Moses and the elders of Israel returned to the camp. Now a wind went out from the Lord and drove quail in from the sea. It scattered them up to 2 cubits deep all around the camp, as far as a day's walk in any direction. And all the people, and all that day and night and all the next day, the people went out and gathered quail. No one gathered less than 10 homers. Then they spread them out all around the camp. But while the meat was still between their teeth and before it could be consumed, the anger of the Lord burned against the people, and he struck them with a severe plague. Therefore, the place was named Kibroth Hatavah, because there they buried the people who had craved other food. From Kibroth Hatavah, the people traveled to Hazeroth and stayed there."
As I was saying before, one of the things about our world today is that we live in a world now which I think most people will agree has an increasing number of addiction. Today, people seem to be hooked on everything. If you go to a restaurant or a cafe, you see people looking at their phone while they're sitting. Even talking to each other or even having a meal, people are on their phones looking at something. On the train, people are always on a device. They've got things dangling out of their ears or Even when in driving now, we now have our government has now put all these cameras on the road to see if people are looking at their phone while they're driving. It seems today that people are hooked on stuff. Addiction has always been part of the human nature. It seems that, we're always hooked on something. I think it was Augustine who once said that, we have a hole in our heart, and that hole in our heart needs to be filled by God. It needs to be filled by Jesus. But the thing is, if the human heart isn't filled by Jesus, then what happens is people will try to find their satisfaction by filling their heart with something else. It's just a part of us. Every human being is born into the world. When we're born into the world, one of the first things we do is we have these attachments. We have these needs in us. A newborn baby goes onto its mother's breast and it drinks milk from its mother. It needs to be filled. It's got this constant appetite, and when the appetite isn't met, it starts to cry. In my house, I've got a cat. And if he's not fed in the morning, 6:30 in the morning, I hear this wailing, meow, meow. And he wants to be let out and he wants to go and have some food. And so we have these addictions. And for every single person, when we say an addiction, we think sometimes maybe it's a person who's on drugs, a person who has an alcohol dependency or something like that. But if you think about an addiction is just something that we go back to all the time because we're trying to get something from this object. There used to be a cartoon called Peanuts with Charlie Brown. And there's a little boy in that cartoon strip called Linus. And Linus is this funny little kid who walks around with a blanket. He constantly holds on and cuddles his blanket and sucks his thumb. And all the other characters in the cartoon try to get Linus to separate from his blanket. Lucy particularly hates it. She keeps saying, "You and that stupid blanket, why don't I just take it off you?" But then she tries to take the blanket off Linus. But when she does it, Linus kind of goes into a meltdown. He kind of goes into, he has this nervous breakdown, and he will grab another object. So he never actually loses his attachment to the object. And even though he's not a baby anymore and he should let go of the blanket, he still keeps carrying it around with him, and he continues to suck his thumb and like this self-soothing activity. And it's a funny take on it. But if you think about it, we all have these addictions, and it might not be a drug, it might not be booze, it might not be alcohol, but there might be something else that we're hooked on. If you think about the internet is a great tool for things like finding out the news, doing research. But the problem is with the internet is that it carries with it this whole bag of addictions. In the last 20 years, that the addiction to pornography has just blown out of proportion. It's just grown like nothing else. And at the moment, it's an industry that creates billions of dollars because people, before, if you wanted to look at pornography, you would go down to a news agent. You would take the magazine, it would be put in a brown paper bag so that people wouldn't see what you had been buying. You would have to do the walk of shame to your car. But now, because of the easy access of that stuff on the internet, you've now got easy access to it, and you don't even have to leave your home to do it. You can even do it in the privacy of your own home without anyone knowing you're even looking at it. And it is that dangerous. And so addiction's just kind of blown out of proportion. It's people are now addicted to Netflix, entertainment, distraction. And what the problem with addictions is that most addictions are actually not in themselves dangerous. If a person is addicted to food, for example, there's nothing particularly dangerous about food. But if you start to overeat food, or if you start to eat too much of a good thing, too much sugar, well, you end up with diabetes, you end up with obesity, high blood pressure, hypertension, and all sorts of other things. And so it's no longer a thing that you're just enjoying. It's a thing which you cannot think you can do without. You can't function without it. If you find yourself waking up every morning and the first thing that you do is you look at your Facebook page, which I often find myself doing, you start to think, well, I must be addicted to this thing. It must have a power over me. I've given this thing power over me because I've chosen to pursue it. And I keep looking at it. There's something I'm trying to get from it. That kind of thing is addictive. And possibly because people are so lonely these days, they are trying to find a substitute for real friendship or substitute for God or something else in these things. And they are good things. Facebook is good for keeping in connection with people. It's good for telling people how you're going. I have a lot of friends overseas in America and other places who want to know how I'm going. I have people I'm ministering to in Africa. The only way I can connect with them really is through Facebook. But when it becomes more than that and it becomes something else and you think you find yourself wanting to go to it all the time, you get anxious and stressed when you can't access it, when you find yourself getting annoyed with others because they are stopping you from getting to it, when you start going through all sorts of things like what they call withdrawal symptoms, or you find yourself not being able to function without it or thinking that you can't function without it, then at that stage it's actually taking a hold over you and you'd have to say it's an addiction. And the worst thing about addiction, according to one of the people I was reading, is that addiction takes you away from good things. Your attachment to this one thing, or might be more than one thing, it might be food plus internet plus something else, these things start taking your time, and the time that it's taking you away from is taking your time away from God. It's taking you away from just enjoying life. It takes you away from blessing others and loving others, and it becomes all-consuming. And one of the greatest examples of an addict in literature would have to be Gollum, because he's got this ring of power and he thinks that he cannot do without it. He killed to get it. He has run away from others to have it so no one else can take it from him. He has become deformed. He has become wretched. He has this constant craving that he can never shake off. And even when he wants to go back to his old way of life and enjoy friendship again, and there's a beautiful scene in Lord of the Rings where he reaches out to Frodo and massages his knee because he wants to have friendship. The other part of him, the addicted part of him, takes over because he's lost the inner battle to fight his addiction. And I think it's a great picture of what addiction is. And sadly, you know, if you think about it, we're all addicted to something. And even if you become a Christian, there are still things you continue to have an addiction to, because you learn to survive with this addiction. You learn to survive because it gave you something. It gave you a sense of belonging, or it gave you a sense of comfort. But the thing is, if you keep holding on to your addiction, you will eventually push God away, because you'll say to God, I'm sorry, this thing gives me more comfort than you. And if you continue doing that, you're basically saying to God, I had this idol and I just don't want to give it up. Excuse me. And I think that's what we see here in Numbers chapter 11, because the people of Israel, the sons of Israel, have been taken out of Egypt. They're on their way to their promised land. In this promised land, God has got so many good things for them. He wants to bless them. He is going to bless them with a land flowing with milk and honey. But the problem is, these people continue to grumble. And in this chapter, you see what I call this dynamic of attachment. So you've got the attachment to the old Egypt. It was the devil they knew. They actually say this in 11 verse 5. We remember the fish which we ate freely in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leek, the onions and the garlic. They had this old attachment to the old things. I preached on Numbers 20 today, and in there they remember pomegranates and all these other fruits. They are continually going back to Egypt. In chapter 16, it's pretty horrible. They actually say to Moses, you have taken us from a land flowing with milk and honey, and you have not taken us to the land flowing with milk and honey, which means they still have this attachment to Egypt. Their attachment to Egypt never goes, because when Joshua dies, he actually says to them, you still worship the gods of Egypt. They continue to worship other gods all through the Old Testament, and eventually God exiles them. And even in the days of Jesus, they are still hooked on addictive substitutes that are not God. So Israel never kind of completely gets rid of these old attachments. And even though God has been so gracious to them, he has shown them through miracles and through his love and patience and provision, they are still pushing God away and saying, we don't want what you've got to give us. we just want to go back to the old stuff. And their minds play tricks on them, because they say, for example, in verse 5, when they say, remember the fish which we freely ate? Well, they didn't freely eat fish. They ate the fish because they were under the yoke of slavery. When they reminisce about their time in Egypt, they never ever remember the slavery. And in fact, because of this, they continue to push God away. So instead of letting go of the old attachment to Egypt and attaching to God and Moses, it's almost like they're drag kicking and screaming through the wilderness because they are still holding on to the old attachment. So that's where the addiction is, because instead of giving up the old destructive attachment to Egypt and the things that they enjoyed there and holding on to God, they are continuing to hold on to the bad. And so this dynamic is going to cause problems for them. The scary thing about this chapter really is that they pushed this so hard that basically God says to them in verse 18, consecrate yourselves for tomorrow, you shall eat meat. You have wept in the hearing of the Lord, saying, who will give us meat to eat? For it was well with us in Egypt. Therefore, Yahweh, God, will give you meat and you will eat it. And you'll eat it not one day, not two, not five, not 10, but not 20 days, but a whole month, until it comes out of your nostrils and it becomes loathsome to you. It's like God is saying, look, if you want to be an addict, if you want to have a substitute above me, you want to choose something better than me, and if you think meat will whet your appetite, well, okay, I will give you meat, and you will have it so much that it will ooze out of your head. And so instead of God saying no to them, I'm not going to give you that, it's not really good for you, God is basically saying, well, actually, this time I will just give you over to it. I will completely give you over to it. And Moses is wondering in verse 21, well, I've got 600,000 men on foot, and yet you've said, I'll give them meat. Where am I going to find the meat from? And God says, well, don't worry about that, I'll provide the meat. And then in verses 31 to 35, the quail comes down from over the sea, and the people stay up all night gathering it. They are so desperate. In verse 32, they stay up all that day and all night, and the next day, that's 2.5 days. That is nonstop. They do not rest. They do not sleep because they are that desperate to get their fill. They gather 10 homers, which is the smallest amount that they gather. According to verse 32, the smallest gathered amount is 10 homers, which I looked up a chart, is about 200 kilograms each. So that's if 200 kilograms is the smallest amount that they are hoarding, then that's just the smallest amount. Then how much of the biggest amount are they gathering? It must be like a ton. I mean, they are that desperate for meat that they are pretty much stuffing themselves. And verse 33 is quite evocative, very powerful. It says, while the meat was still between their teeth, before it was chewed, the wrath of God was aroused against the people, and the Lord struck the people with a very great plague. Their addiction literally kills them. It's quite vivid, it's quite horrible, but there it is. It's that their addiction kills them. He strikes the people with a very great plague. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, Paul actually picks up this image of this event in 1 Corinthians 10 and says, do not enjoy the things of this world, be addicted to the things of this world, because they will take you away from Christ. And what happened to the Israelites in the book of Numbers is an example to you, to us, the modern church, to make sure that we don't get attached to the things of this world and forfeit heaven. The writer of Hebrews is very emphatic upon this. In chapters 3 and 4, he says, do not grumble like they did in the wilderness and lose their earthly inheritance for the promised land, or we will do the same thing. If we continue to hold on to our addictions after we've been saved, we are at great risk of those addictions overthrowing us. In Hebrews chapter 12, which I think is the strongest example he gives the example of Esau. He said Esau was such an addict. He doesn't say the word addict, but it basically says he was so addicted that he wanted a bowl of soup. He chose a bowl of soup, red lentil soup, over all his all his inheritance, all his blessings, and he gave it up for a bowl of soup. But then he was full of bitterness, and because of his bitterness, his sexual immorality overthrew him. The bitterness is caused by the faithlessness, and that overthrows the soul. The soul is overthrown by these things. And even though he cries with tears to get them back, he can't get them back because he has chosen what he really wanted. If you read the story of Esau and Jacob in the book of Genesis, Esau doesn't give up his inheritance once. He actually does it a number of times, which means that by giving it up more than once, he's literally saying, I really don't want my earthly blessings. I really don't want them. But I'll have my addiction. I'll have the soup. But see, you can't have your soup and you can't have your God's blessings at once. Jesus said this in a different way. He said, you can love money and you can say you love God, but you cannot have the two rival passions together. You cannot have the two rivals because one will overthrow the other. If you try and love things of this world with the things of God, eventually you'll have to choose which one you want to serve. And most likely, if you want to serve one of those things, you will serve what you're addicted to rather than God. The addiction will have a greater power. The power of your love for that addicted object will be greater than your love of God. And you might actually give up God, give up Jesus, because you've got your roots stuck in this world. And that's the most dangerous thing about addictions, is that they ground us more and more in the world. You know, if a person is addicted to pornography, for example, then what they're doing is they are saying, I don't want to wait for my blessings. I want my blessings right now. I want to feel good right now. I want to feel ecstasy, orgasm right now. I want to feel all these good bodily things. But by doing that, you're saying, I'm not going to wait for my blessings. I'm going to get rid of anything that gets in my way because I've got to have it now. It's desperate craving. And that's the same for anything, whether it's pornography addiction, whether it's food addiction, whatever it is, there's something going on. Because when the Israelites actually die in the wilderness from this incident in verse 34, the name of that place is called Kivrot Hata'ava, which means the graves of craving, the graves of desire. It's a pretty telling name because the thing is, as the writer of Hebrews warns, that if we're going to get to the promised land, we're going to get to heaven. Us Christians who want to get to heaven, that's our promised land. But if we keep our roots in this world and we keep enjoying the things of this world too much, then what will happen is eventually we'll give up heaven. And we don't want to get there. We don't want to say that we're saved by Jesus. We're one day going to go to heaven, only to keep indulging our sins and our addictions. And then we get to heaven and we say, oh, please let me in. And God says, well, please get away from me. I never knew you. And if you've been reading in your sermon series on Revelation, the seven letters to the seven churches, there is a repeated warning. You need to change this thing in your life, in your church life, in your individual life, because otherwise you won't overcome and you won't get to the end. Those warnings are all very serious. And yes, we do rejoice in the fact that we are predestined for salvation and so on. But the life that we live now, between now and the end, is really important. We all have these attachments. We all have these addictions, as I said. The question is not whether we have addiction. The issue is, what do we do with our addictions? If we find ourselves going to food, for example, at the end of the day, we're feeling really tired, we're feeling really stressed. Naturally, we want to go do something. Some people go to the pub. So alcohol becomes the addiction. It might be we go right straight to the refrigerator. We want some kind of pick-me-up. We want a sugar boost. We might want coffee. We might go to the computer to look at our Facebook page or something. Whatever the thing is that we're going to this for something. We're going to it for a pick-me-up. We're going to it because we want some comfort. If we look at our addictions, we can actually say, well, what is it that I'm trying to get from this thing? Am I trying to get appreciation? I've had a long day. I'm feeling very stressed. So when I'm stressed, I want to feel loved. I want to feel appreciated. But if I come home and I don't feel appreciation from my wife or from my children or from my mother and my dad and all this kind of thing, well, I start to feel stressed. And so I start getting angry. And I'm angry because deep down I don't feel loved. Those kinds of things are all important to understand, because if we can understand them, we can say, actually, I don't need food to pick me up. I mean, I might enjoy a bit of fruit, but, you know, maybe instead of eating junk, I can eat some fruit. I can eat something healthy. But then instead of just going to food, I can actually go to my Heavenly Father. I can actually redirect my addiction to an object, a worldly object, whether it's my work or my accomplishments or whatever it is that I'm addicted to. And I can turn that to God and I can say, God, I'm feeling so tired. I'm feeling so stressed. I'm feeling so worn out. I really, really need you to come and feed me. I need your spirit to fill me up. I need your love to surround me. And one of the books that I've been reading about addiction is that the only thing that overcomes addiction is God's grace. I think that's an absolutely marvelous thing to understand and get our minds around, because it's grace. See, in the law can say to you, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that, you shouldn't eat too much candy, you shouldn't go on the internet, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do this. But see, the law cannot kill addiction. The law only reminds you that you have an addiction. It reminds you that you have an unmet need, which is really what addiction is all about. It's about trying to meet your own need through your own methods. The law only reminds you that you have an unmet need, but the law cannot actually fill that need for you. In Romans chapter 7, where Paul talks about, he says, you know, I cannot do what I want, and I don't do what I should. In the context of that chapter, he uses the law a lot. He talks a lot about the law. He said, you know, the law cannot restrain sin. Law cannot restrain addiction, because law is an outward force telling you, you know, you should do this, you should do this. But that doesn't stop addiction. Telling an addict you shouldn't keep drinking alcohol doesn't stop them from drinking alcohol. Putting an image on a cigarette packet of a cancerous lump doesn't stop people from smoking. What changes is what happens in the heart, because it's the person has to say, you know, I've got to stop this. I don't want this. There is something better for me if I give this up. But until then, those laws telling you you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't do that won't change the heart. In chapter 8 of Romans, where he talks about being able to overcome addiction and overcome these sinful proclivities, he actually says the Spirit. If you count the number of times he says the word Spirit in chapter 8 of Romans, it's astronomical. It's almost about 20 times he says it's the Spirit. So Romans 8 verse 11, if the Spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead dwells in you, he who raised Christ from the dead will also give life to your mortal bodies through his Spirit who dwells in you. And I believe that he comes across the secret, as it were, the mystery of overcoming sin and addiction, because he's basically saying, if you feed on the Spirit and the Spirit is alive in you and you are open to the Spirit, you are making decisions that flow from the Spirit, you will be able to overcome these things. You will be able to overcome because you'll be empowered by the Spirit. We can't fight addiction on our own. We cannot do it on our own. But see, the Israelites, they don't challenge their addiction. They go through their addiction. They push through their addiction. They will do anything to get their hands on it. And the more an addict does that, the more they stay trapped in blaming other people for the consequences of their choices and all those sorts of things, the further away they are from grace, because it's only grace. The addict can't overcome it himself. He's too powerless. The addiction's so strong, and especially if they haven't worked through the roots of their addiction and why they are addicted to those particular things, they'll just keep pushing. Or they might give up that one addiction and they'll pick up another one somewhere else. You know, many alcoholics have given up alcohol only to turn to drugs. And that doesn't help at all. In 1 Corinthians 6 verse 12, Paul says, all things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be mastered by anything. And so Paul is saying, I will not be an addict. I will not be enslaved by anything. Nothing will control me except for the law of Christ, the love of Christ. No, nothing else will master me. And I think today Christians need to be saying this to ourselves every day. I will not be mastered by anything. And in 1 Corinthians 9:27, he says, I discipline my body. I bring it into subjection lest, after I have preached to others, I myself will become disqualified. You know, Paul is saying, I am going to fight my addiction. I will fight my flesh because I will find my satisfaction only in Jesus. And that's where our addictions are powerful, because instead of shutting down our addiction, saying, I will not be addicted to this thing anymore. I will just not do it again. I will overcome by my sheer will and I will just not be an addict anymore. Well, that kind of misses the point. The point is not to end your addiction so much as to redirect your addiction and say, instead of finding my satisfaction in this thing, work, a good reputation, money, sex, drugs, alcohol, or those other things, or food, instead of finding my satisfaction in those things, I will take my appetite to God and I'll let him fill me with his spirit and with his love so that I will not do those things anymore. And the one last Bible verse that I have found very helpful is Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 13. That's Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 13. My people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and they have made for themselves cisterns, broken cisterns that hold no water. So by running away from God, Israel had made broken cups. If you just imagine my little Mr. Strong mug, if I smash it on the ground and it falls into 1,000 pieces and then I get some sticky tape and stick it back together again and try and drink from it. That's what an addiction is. It's trying to make it yourself. It's trying to feed yourself with this broken thing that can't hold water. And the fact that it doesn't hold water, it just runs through, means that no matter what you try and do to try and feed yourself, you're going to be constantly frustrated. It's a very frustrating thing to try and feed yourself with something that can't get in there. And it just creates more panic and more fruitless activity, like a rat spinning on a wheel. But the clue there is in the verse, they have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters. All they have to do is put down the broken cup, turn to God and go to the fountain of living waters and say, you are the living waters, only you can satisfy me. I've been running around all these hundreds of years going to other gods, but none of them can satisfy me like you do. Come, Father, and help me. So this there, I think, is the thing for us, is that if you find yourself as a Christian, or even if you're not a Christian and you are addicted, yes, realize that you have an addiction. An addiction is a sin because it's taking you away from God. You're trying to find your happiness and your satisfaction in something that you are doing or through some attachment that you have chosen to enjoy. But you need to say what that is, work out why you're addicted to that particular thing, what hook it has in you. And then you can take that to God and say, God, I am so addicted to this thing, but you know what? I don't want to be holding on to this anymore because it won't satisfy me. I want you to satisfy me in the way that only you can, because you made me. You put these desires in me, desires for love, desires for friendship, desires for all these other things. And instead of going to my own things and suffering for doing that by walking away from you, I actually want you to come and satisfy me. Can you satisfy me? And so one of the important things is in doing that is that how do we let God satisfy us? He's always standing there. He's always providing. Just as the Israelites were provided for by God with the manna, instead of grumbling about the manna, we can say, God, thank you for the manna. Thank you for your provision. Thank you, God, for all the good things you've given me. Thank you for the roof over my head. Thank you for the clothes on my back. Thank you for the children you've given me. Thank you, God, that I get to be on this earth every day living. Thank you for the blue sky. Thank you for the rain. Thank you for the job that I have. A spirit of thankfulness and gratitude will actually feed that. And then you'll see that God is providing for you. Instead of going, thinking back to the old ways, well, yeah, you know, I know that slavery in Egypt was real horrible, but you know what? At least we had garlic. If you're reminiscing about the past and what you used to enjoy, well, that's not going to help. You can just look at what God is giving you now and say, thank you, God. Help me to enjoy what you're giving me right now. Thank you for Jesus dying on the cross. You keep going back to the cross. You know, you died for my sin. You knew my greatest need. You met my greatest need. Thank you so much. And when Jesus was wandering in the wilderness for 40 days, he had the opportunity to feed himself. He could have turned the stones into bread. But instead, he said, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to wait for my provision from my heavenly Father because I don't want to take it into my own hands. That is someone who has mastery over himself. So we can pray, God, help me to master myself, control myself, so that I'm not mastered by my desires, so that I can enjoy you. I can enjoy the good things you give me, like good food, like a cup of coffee, but they're not going to master me because I want to get to the end of this life and get to the promised land and be with you. And I can't do that if I'm still attached to all these things back here. So, you know, we can even thank God for the things that we've been addicted to. Thank you that I have a computer. Thank you that I have good food. But God, I want your love to control me and to fill me and to satisfy me. And that's it.
We've got one now on Padlet. What's the line between enjoying something and addiction? Felix?
Yeah, that is a very good question, and it is a fine line. I think the fine line is this. It's, the fine line, I would say, is between being able to enjoy something in itself without craving it. I think the fact is, if you start to crave it and you want to have it, in the literature that I've been reading about addiction for my thesis, one of the things that an addict will start to do is that addiction requires constant reinforcement. So you enjoy something, say for example, you enjoy a certain kind of food, but then it gives you a pleasure that a certain other food doesn't give you, or a certain activity doesn't. And so what happens is you start seeking that thing out again. You actually start, you start to plan getting it. You start to get anxious when you don't have it, almost like a baby throwing a tantrum when its dummy's taken away from it. You find yourself almost obsessing about it. There's a level of obsession. For example, if you, when people are on social media, they write something and they count how many people are liking it. Even though it's not something tangible that you can touch with your hands, the fact that people want to be liked, people want to be publicly approved of, that can be a form of addiction, because you're fishing for compliments, as it were. So there has to be, if someone says to you, "Oh, good work, I think you've done a great job, thank you so much." We all want to hear that. And even God said that when we stand before him, he will say, "Well and done, good and faithful servant," if we have obeyed him. But then if you're seeking that all the time, then it becomes unhealthy, because it's no longer about just enjoying that thing just for itself. You almost become driven to get it. And if you don't get it, then you become needy, you become irritable. So I think that's where you start to see the line crossing. And I think the faster you can detect that, I think it will be better, because the sooner you can detect it, you can say, "Oh, I think I'm getting a bit too hooked on this thing. But why does this thing have such a hold over me?" People are not addicted to everything. Some people, for example, as John said before, one person's addicted to gaming. I've never had gaming as a problem myself. I've never had gambling as a problem. I know that some people in my family did, but I've never had gambling as a problem. But for other people, gambling's a huge problem, because it might have been that they grew up in a house with poverty and they hated the shame of poverty. So they go to gambling because they think it's a get-rich-quick fix. And so for them, money is an idol. But it's an idol for a reason. There's a wound there. There's a root. And so I think that's why it's important to chase the roots of addiction, because no addiction is, I don't think addictions are ever there without a reason. There is always a reason. And so there might be a clue in a family generation, something generational about that or something. But if you're finding yourself crossing that line, I'd be saying, well, there's something you're trying to get from that. And so, yeah, you can enjoy something beautiful. A man can look at a beautiful woman and say, "Oh, yeah, she's beautiful," but not lust after her. That is possible. But if you find that you're stepping over that line from enjoyment, from appreciation to, sinful enjoyment, then I think that's where you've got to kind of pull yourself up and go, okay, this is a problem for me. Where's it coming from? And how can I redirect that desire to God so that he feeds me, rather than seeking that from something else or someone else?
Okay, thanks, Felix, for that. It's a follow-up question, more related to the first one. Is there a difference between addiction and a once-off periodic desire for something. For example, craving a certain food every now and then, or an activity or hobby, assuming there is nothing sinful about the activity itself.
Yeah, great question. I think there's nothing wrong with it. You know, this is where you have a difference between an addiction and a habit. See, a habit is like getting up every morning at 7 o'clock. You wouldn't necessarily call that an addiction. It's a habit and you need it to function. I think that's the difference between an addiction and a habit or something else, is that addictions are no longer functional. And normally addictions are not something that you need just for survival. It's something that's taken to a greater excess. I think that's where it becomes something greater. In 1 John, for example, he says, you know, how can a Christian keep sinning? If you are a Christian, you shouldn't sin. And you're thinking, my gosh, how do you... I remember first reading that as a young Christian and thinking, what on earth is he talking about? I mean, he says in 1 John 1, he says, if you confess your sins, God will forgive you. But later on, he says, how do you, you know, a Christian shouldn't keep sinning. And I was thinking, what's he talking about? Then I thought, perhaps what the difference is that when he's talking later about a Christian not making a habit of sin, that seems to me to be talking about besetting sins, what the early church called besetting sins. Sins are compulsion. So you've got regular, you've got kind of like one-off sins. The Old Testament, funnily enough, made this distinction. In the book of Leviticus, it says that there are sins of intention and sins of non-intention. And it actually makes a difference between them. If you are a Christian who sinned by accident, you have a one-off, you were caught in traffic, you got angry in traffic and you swore in traffic and you gave the next driver the middle finger. Okay, that wasn't a godly thing to do. You were speeding, that's not a godly thing to do, but that might just be a one-off. And if that's a one-off, well, a one-off is a one-off. It's not necessarily a habit. But if you find yourself speeding every time you get in the car, you're getting angry every time you get in the car, every time you turn on the computer, you're looking at dirt on the internet, you find yourself needing a drink, or you say to yourself, I need a drink every night, I would say you're starting to cross into addiction, because it is becoming a regular activity. And you might notice that your will to stop it is not powerful enough. And so that issue of will, being able to stop it, finding yourself unable to stop it even though you want to, hints quite strongly of an addiction. And so I think that's where you're saying, okay, every now and then I have an outburst of frustration, right? But that is not necessarily an addiction or an addictive habit, like a sin. It is a sin, but it might not necessarily have been an addictive one. So if I'm going back to something again and again, then that's more indicative of something besetting. It's something that's continuing. And if I find that when I became a Christian 20 years ago, and that was a problem, and I'm looking at my life now and it is still a problem, then you can be very sure that that is a besetting sin. That's what I think John is talking about in 1 John chapter 3 or 4, that this is where I need to start getting a bit more serious about this thing in my life, and I need extra resources to help me get through it. So it might be an accountability group. It might be something else that I need to get, so that I've got people praying for me. When I'm prompted to look at that thing, I've got some accountability. I've got other things that can kind of come in upon me and to help me overcome it and fight it. Because if I don't, then this thing can overwhelm me. And in my own church, I saw one man who used to come to my church a long time ago who was addicted to sweet food, who was addicted to Coke. He used to drink it for about 50 years. And eventually it caught up with him. And when I saw this man in hospital, he was having his toes amputated. He'd already had about 4 amputated and they were thinking of amputating his whole foot. And he said to me, he said, I ignored the warnings. I should have listened when my family told me, but now it's costing me my feet. And they were thinking of even amputating fingers. But even something as small as food, the consequences further down the track, you'll have to pay for them later. So that's one of the things I think that you know, there is a difference, I think, between a one-off sin and a more addictive sin. But I think the addictive ones have a much more of a power. So I think they're the ones that, you know, we need to be focusing a lot of our attention on, because if we don't fight that, then what will happen is it'll just spiral out of control.
Okay, thanks, Alex, for that. So far, there is no other questions. So we might get away. It's only just two questions, so that's pretty good. Get off easy.
I might just ask one to finish off, if that's all right, Steve.
Sure, go for it.
We have time.
Yep.
In your sermon, you were saying, like, the ultimate cure for addiction is grace. Do you have any thoughts, like, in your reading for your thesis about kind of particular, I don't know what you call it, like habits or means of grace or something that are particularly effective for overcoming addiction?
And that's pretty much the focus of my thesis, actually, is what are the practical things to put in place to make sure that we are receiving the love of God. I think one of the things that Protestant Christianity has eschewed, abandoned actually, is the confessional aspect of Christian faith, which is, I have an addiction. I have sin in my life. I need accountability. I need to confess to someone, because where there is confession, there is healing. There is freedom. It's awfully hard in our individual society. Our society is incredibly individualistic and self-centered, and what that means is that it's all about me. But what that also means is that I don't want anyone to know what's really going on in my life. I don't want to open up. I don't want to tell anyone. What will everyone think of me? And if I'm worried about that, then I'm not going to be honest. I'm not going to be seeking openness. I might say I do, but deep down I really don't, because I don't want anyone to know the real me. And so people put these masks on. They act like it's all okay, it's all working out. But deep inside, they're full of doubt, they're full of insecurity. And it's horrible. It's self-imposed law, if you think about it, because you're thinking, I have to look good. And what will they think of me if I don't look good? And it eats you up because you feel so lonely and disconnected, and that feeds sin. Satan goes in those places and says, "Well, I think one of the most important things for overcoming sin and addiction is community. Strong, healthy, safe community." Jesus said in Matthew 15, "Out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, theft, false witness, blasphemies." And so, if they're coming from our heart, well, how did they get into our heart? How do we get to the point where we have become so attached to these things that we can't, or think we can't, give them up? Somewhere along the line, we need to talk about that. And it, so I think having accountability is one thing. If you need to see a Christian counselor, that might be another thing. But accountability is a big thing, because you are able to, for example, I used to be addicted to sex, and so on a Friday night, you're tempted to go out and drink with people and get loose. And so I used to just have people that I could, I just call up a friend and say, look, I'm feeling really tempted tonight. Can you pray with me? Can you hang out with me? And it was so amazing. One person invited me to one of their church events in the city, and I started going to church on a Friday night. And I actually found that meeting with God's people on a Friday night was actually a really effective way for me to overcome those temptations. And so I think community is very undervalued, even in the church today. So I think that's a really important one. Fasting can help, because by fasting, the Catholics do this around Lent. By fasting, you say, okay, I'm not going to look this week at Facebook. I'm not going to eat this food this week. I'm going to actually abstain from one of my addictions this week, because by doing this, I want to learn to function without it. And as you do that, and you can do it for longer and longer and longer, I actually feel that actually has a restraining influence, and you can actually start to either give it up altogether or just use it in its proper moderation. So I think that those things can help. Spending time in God's word and praying are so important. Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Felix. I hope that answers the questions, John.